Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 210, Fort Vincennes and the Northwest Territory. In early 1779, a group of Virginians attacked Fort Vincennes, which sits on the Wabash River in what is today Indiana, right on the Illinois border. In 1779, this was deep into Indian territory, where few people of European descent had settled or even traveled. This week, I want to take a closer look at the Western dispute that flared up so far away from the main areas of battle. The British retained outposts deep in the continent's interior in order to maintain claims to all the land that had not been settled or governed by any other European power. The few white settlers in the area were almost all French, whose families had come to what is today Canada before the British took control of that region in the 1760s. Henry Hamilton was the British official who was in charge of the area. He was Irish by birth and was not of any relation to Alexander Hamilton, in case anyone was wondering. His father had descended from aristocracy, but with that title passing to other firstborn relatives. His father was still part of a wealthy and powerful family and served in the Irish Parliament. His older brother, Sackville Hamilton, would also serve in the Irish Parliament and would later become Undersecretary to the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. Henry grew up in Ireland as a younger son and followed in the traditional route of joining the regular army as an officer. In 1755, at the age of 21, he received an ensign's commission. He had risen quickly to captain when the French and Indian War began, serving under General Guy Carleton. Hamilton fought at the Battle of Quebec and the Siege of Louisbourg. By the end of the war, he served as a brigade major. As with many peacetime officers, Hamilton's position in the army stagnated after the war. He returned home with his regiment, but then came back to Quebec when the American Rebellion began to heat up in 1775. Hamilton was still a military officer at this time, but served mostly in administrative positions in Quebec. In 1775, London offered him a new opportunity. The North Ministry created 5 lieutenant governorships in Quebec. This was part of the expansion of the Quebec territory that Parliament had approved in the Quebec Act of 1774, one of several laws that came to be known collectively as the Coercive Acts or Intolerable Acts that set off colonial violence. Hamilton sold his commission in the army and began a new political career as a lieutenant governor and commander of Fort Detroit in what is today Michigan. Other lieutenant governors took posts at Vincennes in what is today Indiana and Kaskaskia near the settlement of St. Louis. Like other new lieutenant governors, Hamilton was pretty much on his own at a distant outpost with few resources. By the time he left for Detroit in the fall of 1775, Americans were already invading Quebec and besieging the capital city. Hamilton had a few companies of regulars and a handful of local administrators who were mostly leftovers from French rule. The judge for his territory had lost his authority with the passage of the Quebec Act, but since there was no replacement for him, Hamilton simply allowed the judge to continue handing out judgments. Because he had no real government to administer, Hamilton's real role was more of a diplomat. His job was to convince the few French Canadians and the local Indian tribes to remain neutral in any coming fights. By most accounts, he developed a good working relationship with the leaders of the local Ottawa and Huron tribes. As the war progressed, Hamilton pushed for a more aggressive role. In 1777, he encouraged local warriors to go on the attack against Western settlements, where supporters of American independence were taking hold. He received the nickname Hair Buyer because of rumors that he paid for each rebel scalp that the warriors collected. There are some who dispute that Hamilton actually paid for scalps, but there is no question that he encouraged Indian attacks on American settlements. Initially, the program was a great success. The Indians took hundreds of scalps and forced many settlers to abandon the Western territories. Governor Hamilton seemed willing to overlook the fact that many of the scalps seemed to come from women and children. In a few cases, the warriors brought back live prisoners. One of those prisoners was a man named Daniel Boone, whom Hamilton met in Detroit. Hamilton had hoped to keep Boone a prisoner there, but the Indians who captured him refused to turn him over. Instead, they wanted to accept Boone into their tribe. Later that year, Boone escaped and returned to Kentucky. Although London had decided this territory was part of Quebec, Virginia still claimed that all of this land was part of Virginia. Many of the settlers that had been attacked were composed of Virginians moving west into what became Kentucky, as well as lower Indiana and Illinois. The British-backed Indian raids on these western lands demanded a response. The man in charge of responding was George Rogers Clark. He was the older brother of William Clark from the famous Lewis and Clark expedition. Clark was born in Virginia near Charlottesville in 1752. When he was still a toddler, his family moved further west into the Virginia frontier. Now, this was a particularly dangerous time when France was stirring up Indians to attack British colonists during the French and Indian War. So George remained back east with his grandfather, where he attended the same school as James Madison. Clark, however, only attended school for a short time. He learned a trade as a surveyor, and by age 19 was surveying western lands for Virginia settlers. He also took a commission as a captain in the Virginia militia. In 1774, Captain Clark led a company in the frontier fighting that became known as Lord Dunmore's War. After that, Virginia got the Shawnee to cede control of land south of the Ohio River, thus opening up Kentucky for settlement. There were still a few hurdles for the settlers. Britain had banned settlement west of the Allegheny Mountains via a 1763 proclamation. There were also a number of other tribes who claimed the same land as their own and were not part of the treaty ceding the land. Beyond that, a North Carolina land speculator was attempting to create a new colony out of this land based on a treaty that North Carolina had settled with the Cherokee. To help cement Virginia's claim to this land, Clark and others petitioned the governor to recognize the Kentucky Territory as part of Virginia. By this time, in 1776, Lord Dunmore had fled Virginia. The new governor, Patrick Henry, did not feel constrained by any old royal proclamations, and Governor Henry designated Kentucky as a county in Virginia. The county included all of the land that is the current state of Kentucky. Clark served as military commander of the new county, but it was so lately populated, and Virginia's focus was on the war in the east, so very little happened there. In 1777, after the native tribes began stepping up their attacks on settlers in the region, Clark pushed for a response. In December 1777, Clark presented a proposal to Governor Henry to lead a regiment. Henry approved of that plan in a set of secret orders, and I've included a link to those orders on my blog if you want to take a look at them. But he didn't run these secret orders by the state legislature. Publicly, Clark's mission was just vaguely defined as protecting Kentucky from attack. His secret orders were to attack the enemy outposts north of the Ohio River, evict the enemy, and secure that land for Virginia as well. Henry commissioned Clark as a lieutenant colonel and authorized him to raise a Virginia regiment. Now, these were not militia. Rather, they were going to be regular soldiers commissioned by the state of Virginia. The regiment would sail down the Ohio River from Fort Pitt, then take the British outposts north of the Ohio River that were being used as bases of operations for attacks into Kentucky. Clark had difficulty raising a sizable regiment since most men were already fighting in the larger campaigns to the east. Also, Clark needed to keep his military targets a surprise and could only reveal to potential recruits the vague goal of protecting Kentucky. As he worked to recruit volunteers from Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina for his Illinois Regiment of Virginia, he also sent spies into the Illinois Territory, which includes modern-day Indiana and Illinois, to scout out enemy defenses. While he hoped to raise a regiment of 350 men, he only raised about half that amount for the mission. Undeterred, the group set out from Fort Pitt in May 1778. Their first target was the British outpost at Kaskaskia. Clark faced his first challenge when several of his recruits objected to the plan. They had joined the regiment because Clark told them they were going to be defending Kentucky. They did not sign up for a military offensive into Illinois territory. Several tried to desert, but were dragged back to camp. With threats of execution, Clark managed to keep his new regiment together as they began the journey down the Ohio River. By late June, the regiment was close to where the Ohio joins the Mississippi River. They encountered a group of American hunters who were paddling up the Ohio. The hunters warned Clark that Kaskaskia had lookouts along the Mississippi River to warn about any enemies approaching. With this information, rather than approach by moving up the Mississippi River, Clark landed his regiment on the north bank of the Ohio River and marched overland toward the town. The hunters agreed to guide the regiment through the wilderness to Kaskaskia. The march took longer than expected when the guides got lost. The men carried 4 days' worth of rations, which ran out on about the sixth day of the march. The hungry regiment reached Kaskaskia on July 4th. There, they only encountered local French-speaking population. The British lieutenant governor had abandoned the town and headed up north to Fort Detroit. Clark convinced the French locals to sign loyalty oaths to Virginia and took prisoner several who defiantly backed British rule. His news that France had recently formed an alliance with the Continental Congress helped to encourage the locals to support the Americans. Of course, most locals were happy to support whichever side let them keep their property and generally left them alone. Clark also removed his soldiers from the town as soon as it was secured, leaving only a small garrison at the fort. He wanted to avoid any conflicts between his soldiers and the locals that might turn the local population against him. He also ensured the local priest that Virginia would not interfere with the practice of Catholicism. This light-touch approach seemed to work well. The locals were very happy that their town was not looted and plundered by the enemy army, and most settlers seemed happy to cooperate. Clark's forces next took Vincennes and the British Fort Sackville, again without much of a fight. The local militia who garrisoned the fort swore an oath to Virginia and continued to garrison the fort under an American officer and flying an American flag. No one put up any resistance as Clark's men collected loyalty oaths over much of July 1778 from small settlements around the region and many of the local tribes. Now, there was some resistance. During the occupation, a group of Indians attempted to attack and kill Colonel Clark. After putting down the attack, Clark held several war chiefs in irons and kept them prisoner. Now, many of his Indian allies attempted to intervene and get him to release the prisoners on the promise that they would not attack again. Clark refused to do so. Clark and his men had all had families who had endured merciless Indian raids over the prior 2 years. Many lost friends and family to these attacks. While they were willing to make peace with the Indians who offered peace, they would also treat harshly any Indians who showed an inclination toward continued violence. Clark also reached out to the local Spanish leaders of St. Louis. The Mississippi River marked the border between Spanish territory and the land that was under dispute between Quebec and Virginia. Spain was still neutral at this time and was not helping either side. Clark opened a friendly correspondence with Fernando de Leyva, the lieutenant governor for Upper Louisiana. Governor de Leyva made clear that as long as they stayed on the eastern side of the Mississippi, there would not be any problems. By late summer, Clark had completed his mission. His regiment had been recruited for a term of 90 days, which expired in August. Many of the men who had not wanted to be on this mission in the first place were more than ready to go home, and others were eager to get back home for the winter as well. Clark realized that he needed to hold this new territory, or the British would likely simply come and take it back. He prevailed on the regiment to reenlist for another 8 months. He managed to convince about 100 of the men to remain, but the rest returned home. Up in Detroit, by August, Lieutenant Governor Hamilton received news of the American incursion and the capture of Kaskaskia and Vincennes. Hamilton sent word of this to Quebec, hoping to get some guidance and military assistance from Quebec's governor. He wrote to Guy Carleton, not having heard that Friedrich Haldimand had replaced Carleton in June of 1778. After waiting several weeks and receiving no response from anyone, Hamilton decided to act on his own. Although he was no longer a military officer, Hamilton raised a battalion, which he would lead personally to recapture Vincennes. He took about 30 British regulars from the Detroit garrison, as well as about 175 local French-Canadian militia. He also recruited about 60 Ottawa warriors under the command of Chief Igusha. Hamilton's force left Detroit on October 8, 1778, for a late season campaign that would inevitably continue into the winter. As the British force moved south on the 300-mile journey to Vincennes, they recruited even more native warriors along the way, so that they had roughly 300 warriors for a total of about 500 soldiers by the time they reached Vincennes. Many of the warriors who joined had signed loyalty oaths to Clark only a few weeks earlier. When the British force reached Vincennes in December, the local French-Canadian militia that had garrisoned Fort Sackville immediately abandoned their posts and submitted to the British force under Hamilton. Captain Leonard Helm, whom Clark had left in command of the fort, had no choice but to surrender and become a British prisoner of war. Once again, Vincennes changed hands without any bloodshed. Given the onset of winter, Hamilton remained in Vincennes, reaching out to local settlements and tribes to receive oaths of loyalty to the king. He did not engage in any major acts of retribution for those who had signed loyalty oaths to Virginia. He did not want violence to push the local population into backing the Americans. Hamilton's goal was to use his presence as incentive to get the locals to change their minds back to supporting Britain. He planned to wait until spring to take back Kaskaskia and return all the land north of the Ohio River to his own control. Then Britain could resume attacks on American settlements in Kentucky. At the time Hamilton recaptured Vincennes, Clark was in Kaskaskia, making plans for a spring and summer campaign for 1779. The government in Williamsburg was thrilled with his success the previous summer. He had received promotion to full colonel and was authorized to raise an army of 500 men. Virginia's political leaders had given full confidence to Colonel Clark, who was still just 25 years old. Officials left to his discretion whether he wanted to spend the next summer subduing Indian tribes that had been leading attacks against settlers in Kentucky, or whether he wanted to engage in an all-out assault to take Fort Detroit. Hamilton, retaking Vincennes, disrupted all that and threatened to undo all the work Clark had done to bring local officials into the American camp. Clark realized that he could not wait until spring. He needed to evict the British from Vincennes as quickly as possible. Clark assembled a force of 172 Americans and local French-Canadian militia to retake Vincennes, leaving Kaskaskia on February 6, 1779. The winter was not a terribly cold one, but the nearly 200-mile trip through driving rain created its own difficulties. The force did not reach Vincennes until the evening of February 23rd, by which time it had run out of food. Once again, the locals did not seem to care much about which side was in control. They mostly wanted to avoid suffering the vengeance of the winning side. The Americans were able to enter Vincennes that evening without anyone in town alerting the garrison at Fort Sackville. Governor Hamilton did not realize an attack was coming until the Americans opened fire on the fort. Clark built a barricade opposite the fort's main gate and began to lay siege. Hamilton asked for terms. Clark demanded unconditional surrender, which Hamilton refused. The following day, a group of French Canadians and natives returned to Vincennes, unaware that the Americans occupied the town. After a brief firefight, the Americans captured two French Canadians and four Native Americans as the remainder fled. Clark released the Frenchmen, but not the natives. He lined up the four natives in full view of the fort. He then proceeded to have his men tomahawk the prisoners, killing them and scalping them, then throwing their dead bodies into the river. It was intended to send a message to the fort occupants. It was almost certainly in part also revenge for the many Indian attacks the settlers had endured over the prior years. After one day and two nights of siege, Hamilton realized his situation was hopeless. The French-Canadian militia was unwilling to support him. His Indian allies had returned home for the winter, and the few dozen regulars were no match for the attackers. Over the first day of the attack, the British had suffered 11 killed and 5 wounded. Hamilton surrendered the fort on the morning of February 25, 1779. The Americans renamed Fort Sackville Fort Henry after Governor Patrick Henry and once again raised the Stars and Stripes over the fort. Lieutenant Governor Hamilton became a prisoner and was sent back to Williamsburg in chains. Virginia reasserted its claim to all of the Northwest Territory from Pittsburgh to the Mississippi River and as far north into what is today Canada. George Rogers Clark was widely celebrated and took command of what Virginia's leaders now called the Illinois County of Virginia. Next week, we head back to the area around New York City as the Continental Army settles in for a winter at Middlebrook, New Jersey. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, Trey Nance, George Davis, Lewis White, and George Hunter. Thanks also to Robert Morris Circle supporter, Knox Press, which publishes great books about the American Revolution. They recently published The Alamo of the American Revolution by Gerald Hurwitz. The book is about the 1781 attack on Fort Griswold by then-British General Benedict Arnold. Go to knoxpress.com for more details. Thanks also to all of my Patreon supporters. You guys really helped to make this podcast possible. As the popularity of the podcast has grown, so have my expenses. If you appreciate the fact that I don't jam all sorts of annoying commercials into each episode, I hope you will consider helping me out by making a donation of as little as $2 per month on Patreon. If you have the means, supporters at the $10 level and higher get a free monthly flag magnet up from the American Revolution, along with my deepest gratitude. If you believe that helping spread the understanding of the revolution is a worthy goal, I hope you will join me by helping to cover this podcast's expenses. Go to patreon.com and support the American Revolution podcast. And today, we covered the efforts led by George Rogers Clark to secure the Western territories. Although his actions were not much of a priority to the leaders of the revolution at the time, his efforts helped to secure the Northwest Territory, what we today call the Midwest, to become part of the United States at the end of the war. If the British had held that area, it very likely could have become part of Canada and led to a very different historical outcome. Now, the loser in today's contest was British Lieutenant Governor Henry Hamilton. As I mentioned in the main show, he was taken prisoner and sent to Williamsburg. Virginians deeply despised Hamilton for his instigation of the Native American warriors against Virginia settlements. This was one of the issues that Thomas Jefferson wrote about in the Declaration of Independence in one of its most controversial lines. The quote is, "He has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." Many critics today consider this passage to be racist because it refers to the Indian warriors as savages. I don't want to get into the modern debate about that. The only reason I'm bringing this line to your attention is to note that a whole lot of settlers of European descent at the time absolutely saw the native tribes that way at that time, and they had many real-world examples to substantiate that belief. And yes, some Americans revisited that same sort of savage cruelty on the native tribes as the victims. But of course, when you're in the midst of a war, you tend to focus on the enemy's atrocities and excuse or ignore your own. So my point is simply that Hamilton's policy of encouraging Indian attacks on Virginia settlements made him a particularly evil character in the eyes of the Virginians. Hamilton did not have a military rank. He had resigned his commission in the army when he became lieutenant governor, so he was a civilian leader at the time of his capture. As a result, Virginia did not accord him any rights as a prisoner of war. They treated him as a common criminal. At a time when British generals who had been captured at Saratoga were on parole in Virginia and dining with Thomas Jefferson, Governor Hamilton was held in chains in a Williamsburg prison for over 18 months. It took the personal intervention of George Washington, who was responding to British protests about Hamilton's treatment, before he was finally released. And that release was over the vehement objections of Governor Jefferson. Hamilton was eventually exchanged and returned to England, and he later received some land in Canada for his service to the crown, and also served as a colonial governor of several islands in the West Indies. The hero of today's story, George Rogers Clark, has a future that's nearly the opposite of Hamilton. Following his victory, he was widely celebrated. But after the war, Clark was treated rather horribly. Clark had to spend a great deal of money, much of which he borrowed, in order to win the campaign in the West. Both Virginia and the Continental Congress refused to reimburse him for most of his expenses. They said he did not have sufficient receipts or proof of expenses to justify the reimbursement, and even called some of them fraudulent. Of course, the ability to collect receipts while spending money on the frontier is a near impossibility, but the bean counters back east didn't seem to care about that. After the war, Clark worked as a surveyor. He was surveying lands for war veterans who were promised land on the frontier in thanks for their service. Clark himself received 150,000 acres in what is today southern Indiana. At the time, though, this land was still unsettled and really did not help him to resolve his money problems. Even later, during George Washington's presidency, Clark would get involved with French ambassador Edmond Genet, and he ended up spending thousands of dollars organizing an expedition to open up the Mississippi River, which was controlled by their common enemy, the Spanish. President Washington quashed that expedition and threatened to send in Anthony Wayne and the U.S. Army to prevent the expedition from leaving and violating U.S. neutrality. So Clark's expedition, set up on behalf of France, never got underway. The French then stiffed Clark on his expenses, leaving him in even greater debt. Clark ended up giving away much of the land that he had received in compensation for his service to his family in order to prevent its seizure by creditors. He was living on a small frontier cabin and unfortunately descended into alcoholism. Later, a fire damaged his leg and required amputation, leaving him in even worse condition. He finally did get a small pension, but not until 1812, which was only a few years before his death, and he was already an old and broken man by that time. So Clark died largely poor and forgotten. Now today, of course, he's widely remembered as a hero of the Revolution and the man who secured the Midwest for the United States. There are numerous towns, counties, parks, and other places that are named after him. If you want to read more about Clark, my book recommendation this week is George Rogers Clark, I Glory in War, by William Nestor. This is an award-winning biography that was written about a decade ago. The author is a history professor at St. John's University in New York and has written a host of other history books. There's even an audiobook version. The main problem, if there is one, with this book is that it is out of print, it's difficult to find, and if you can find a copy, it's probably going to be pretty pricey. So, if you can't find George Rogers Clark, I Glory in War at a reasonable price, you might enjoy my online recommendation of the week instead. It's another Clark biography called Conquest of the Country Northwest of the River Ohio, 1778 to 1783, and the Life of General George Rogers Clark, by William English. This book was published in 1897, meaning that it is in the public domain and it's available for free on archive.org as an ebook. It's an extremely comprehensive two-volume book totaling over 1,200 pages, So if you really want to dig into the details of Clark's life, and particularly his military exploits during the Revolution, this ebook is a great option. As always, you can search for it on archive.org or go to the direct links on my website at amrevpodcast.com. And my question this week is, where did the British go wrong in their strategy to defeat the American Revolution? In hindsight, was there any alternative strategy and tactics that could have won the war, or was it always an unwinnable war once Spain and France got involved? Well, in my view, the first place that Britain went wrong was in refusing to adopt a political compromise that kept the colonies happy and going to war in the first place. Even after the outbreak of war, say in early 1776, if Britain had offered the colonies the same peace terms that it offered in 1778, there would have been no Declaration of Independence, and the colonists would have celebrated King George as the defender of British liberties in America. So, yeah, Britain's first mistake was not coming to reasonable terms with the colonies, which they all recognized was a growing power and were going to be a challenge to handle militarily. So the next part of the question is, if we are going to try to crush the colonies militarily, did Britain really have a chance at doing that? And I would say yes, they did. If they had won the New York campaign in 1776, British General Howe had several opportunities recommended to him by his subordinates to surround and capture the Continental Army. Many of those could have worked, even if he had just marched on them a little bit faster when they were retreating across New Jersey. He likely could have completely destroyed the Continental Army, and that very well could have ended the war. But instead, he allowed the bulk of Continentals to escape, and they launched their counterattack at Trenton and Princeton, and that kept the American struggle alive. I think that that was Britain's last real chance to succeed in the war militarily. Once France joined the war in 1778, even most British leaders were no longer fighting to win. They were fighting to minimize their losses. The empire simply did not have the resources to conquer North America and defend its other colonies all over the world. Later, when Spain and the Netherlands piled on, the situation became even more desperate. So yes, Britain did have a chance to win early in the war, but not so much later. If you have a question that you would like to have answered on this podcast, please email me at mtroy.history@gmail.com. I will be happy to answer any interesting questions about the American Revolution. You can find my email also on my website at www.amrevpodcast.com. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast. Thank you.